Welcome to the Swap It Up podcast. We are the youth speaking eco-truth. Hi, welcome back to the Swap It Up podcast. Today we're talking about COP26 and we're joined by Phoebe Hansen, who is at Mock COP26 and COP26. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. Hi, I'm Phoebe. I'm 20. I'm a second year politics student at Lancaster University. And last year I co-coordinated Mock COP26, which is very exciting. And then I went to COP this year, did some things on climate education. It was very exciting. I'm a climate activist on a bunch of things, but mostly on like how we communicate the climate crisis, working with young people to be change makers and to take agency in their own lives. So yeah, very, very linked into Swap It Up.
So let's start off with trying to figure out exactly what it is we're trying to avoid with the climate crisis and what they're trying to do with COP26. So we heard the line specifically, keep 1.5 alive a lot. Can you explain why 1.5 is such an important number?
Yeah, so 1.5, when we say 1.5, we mean 1.5 degrees. You mean 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels of like global warming, global heating. So there was a 2018 like IPCC special report on 1.5, and it basically said that going from 1.5 to 2 degrees of global warming means that like 1.7 million people, more people will experience severe heat waves at least once every 5 years, that seas will rise another 10 centimeters, that like several hundred million more people will be exposed to climate-related risks, to climate-related poverty. 1.5 is our last chance really to have any hope of mitigating, of adapting to, of whatever, to having a world that is livable for human beings. It's our last chance of having an even minute percentage of possibility of surviving in this world. But I think the thing to really focus on is that climate change doesn't only start at 1.5 degrees. Climate change is here right now and people are suffering right now. 1.5 degrees is what we really need to limit our global warming to. And it's something that I don't think we're as a world on track to accomplishing, particularly after the Glasgow Pact. I'm not sure if it did enough. I think Greenpeace said something along the lines of it keeps 1.5 only just alive, and that's not good enough, because 1.5, the difference, as I said, from 1.5 to 2 degrees is a difference in millions of people having a livelihood and having a home and having their family members alive and being alive themselves. 1.5 to 2 degrees is the difference between millions of human rights abuses across the world. 1.5 degrees is the difference between a relatively peaceful society to the exacerbation of conflict across the world, to millions of people having their homes destroyed, millions of children having to worry about whether or not they're going to drown in their bedrooms. 1.5 is the only thing that we have, and it's the only thing that we saw at COP. A lot of people, I'm not sure which country it was, I really should know, that was, they did their COP address knee deep in water to try and convey that their island was physically sinking. We worked with people on Mock COP who had literally almost lost the island that they were born on, because the climate crisis was rising sea levels so much that it had completely been destroyed. And 1.5 is the only hope that we have of stopping so much pain and suffering across the world, and also stopping that from coming to the global north, stopping millions more people dying. It's 1.5 is incredibly, incredibly important, and it's what we need to hold on to. But not only 1.5, I think we also need to be focusing on 2030 as a goal. We need to be focusing on the sustainable development goals. We need to be focusing on making sure that we're raising ambition from the 2050 net zero goals, and net zero is iffy anyway. 1.5 is incredibly, incredibly important. It's my answer to that question.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so clear. And also you've just really clarified the difference in a degree Celsius and how much of a difference that can make. So before going into COP, what did you want to see from like leaders across the world? What do you think could have avoided us going beyond the 1.5 degree tipping point?
What I wanted to see from COP, number one, was a universal commitment to keeping warming to that 1.5 degrees rather than to 2 degrees, because the Paris Agreement, it says like something along the lines of like, we hope we're going to pursue efforts towards limiting warming to 1.5. We're going to pursue it, but it's not legally binding. We can really, you can go ahead away kind of thing. I wanted to see that universal commitment. There was a lot of other things I wanted. I wanted like a total immediate commitment to coal phase out, not phase down, phase out of coal and all fossil fuels as quickly and as rapidly as possible, and with a plan to put that in place, not just like, we're going to do this, like having like, okay, we're going to do this. Here are the people we're going to engage. Here are the stakeholders we're going to work with. Here is how we're going to address it to make sure that it's done in time. And then we also really wanted, I say we as COP26, and then also just as young people, wanted really stronger commitments on climate finance. So climate finance is like, it's complicated. There's a climate finance is like how polluting countries, like global north countries in particular, the finance that they give to the global south countries, more vulnerable countries, in order to mitigate and adapt to it. So there's also something called like loss and damage, which is like adapting to the damage that has already happened, and like a kind of compensation type thing, all kind of under a big wing of climate finance. And then we really wanted some stronger commitments from polluting countries to increase their climate funding, that climate finance funding, because they have funding, they have proposed funding of $1 billion a year, which they haven't hit. And that really isn't enough. And it's just, there's a lot of things. We needed those ambitious targets from polluting nations, and we needed coalitions for people to go towards that loss and damage. We needed to make sure that people were, loss and damage was not on the agenda nearly enough this year. Hopefully it will be next year at COP27. But we needed so much more ambition from polluting nations, and we just didn't get it. But there were steps. It was something. But I saw someone on Twitter, I've completely forgotten who, I think it was Nathan Thankey, and he said something along the lines of, I wouldn't characterize the COP outcomes as like good, but they could have been better. It's that they're very, very bad, but they could have been worse. They could have been catastrophic. And the COP26 outcomes, they keep us, they keep the 1.5 goal only just alive, right? So it's not that they were completely terrible. It's more that we're in a crisis that I wake up every morning and I'm terrified about. We're in a crisis that I know people who have lost their homes, who have lost family members, and this is a crisis that is killing people, and a crisis that is turning people into refugees, or not even close to the 1.5 degree mark. So how much worse is it going to have to get? And COP did not address that at all. And I think there were so many things that could have happened that didn't. And there are so many, I think it's not just necessarily on the black and white commitments that are made on paper. I think there were things in the way that COP could have been structured that would have made it more conducive to a 1.5 goal. It could have been a more inclusive conference. It could have been a conference that engaged young people effectively, not just as like a box ticking exercise of inclusion. It could have been something that, instead of just saying this is the Indigenous COP and saying we're going to use Indigenous knowledge, it could have been something that actually provided support for Indigenous people to get vaccines so they could actually go into the conference centre. It could have been something that gave financial support to Indigenous people so they could quarantine in the UK to follow all the COVID guidelines. It could have been something that put funding towards Indigenous people actually going on those flights or going on those train trips or whatever to get to that conference centre and to fund their accommodation, because it's so expensive to get to Glasgow, especially if you're from, I met a lot of people from Amazonian Indigenous communities who would pay at least 10,000 each to be there. And that's ridiculous, because what that was also in conjunction with is, although they may have had passes, we as observers, which most people are, it's like the you can't really participate, you can just observe kind of like level of pass, lowest level, peasant level of passes, if you will. Most Indigenous communities weren't given delegate badges. They weren't given party badges. They were given observer badges. They couldn't actually go into the negotiating rooms. They couldn't go into the World Leaders Summit. They couldn't go into any of these spaces. So why have they paid 10,000 to be there if you're not going to engage us? If the only times you're going to invite us into a room is to advise and to listen to what we have to say, nod, and then carry on with what you were doing anyway. There were many things that COP could have done a lot better, and that probably would have helped us to get towards some kind of good and some kind of justice for climate. But
yeah, I think that there are, yeah, there are so many things that you've said there, but I think I'd like to just go a bit more into the phase out coal pledge that was made. So at COP, for our listeners, there was a pledge that was made by more than 40 countries to phase out coal, or phase down coal. And we know that burning fossil fuels is one of the causes of climate change and emits a lot of greenhouse gases. So I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the idea of like phasing out or phasing down coal?
But I mean, obviously, it's incredibly disappointing. But as I said, one of the things I really, really wanted from COP is not only a coal phase out, but a commitment to the phase out of fossil fuels in general. Coal is only one fossil fuel. There are many, many others that aren't being included in this. So it's not only incredibly disappointing that it's only coal, it's incredibly disappointing that it's been turned from phase out to phase down. But I think what's also been really missed in that conversation is that it's complicated and it's difficult to explain. I don't fully understand it, but I've had many conversations with people from India and from China, who are the two countries that were really like the ones that were pushing for phase down instead of phase out in the language. And it really has to be taken into consideration that the way that that initial proposal for language was structured is a way that would really, really place burden on India and from global South countries and from those developing economies in a way that is completely unequal to the way that the US and other polluting and rich countries have committed to it. We need to make sure that all of those phase out plans, all of those fossil fuel phase out plans, isn't going to leave countries behind, because that's not how you do diplomacy. We need to make sure that all of the language that we have and all of the safeguards we have in place, all of the diplomacy that we do in spaces like this, that we are not putting things in place that are going to antagonize the global South countries and are going to hold back global South countries from developing economically, because that's always going to be what people will prioritize. It's always going to be what politicians in those countries will prioritize. So we need to make sure that we're not just extending colonialism in the sense of prioritizing rich countries' interests and making sure that it doesn't get to the rich countries, almost like the climate change, like direct effects, making sure that it doesn't get to us as the global north, as the ex-colonialist countries. We need to make sure that all of the diplomacy that we're doing is keeping everyone into consideration. And what I've been really disappointed by is that the conversation around the shift from phase out to phase down has been incredibly, incredibly, it blamed India in a way that is justified, but also needs a lot more nuance to that conversation, because the US is as much an obstructionist to this as India is. The US refused to shut down new fossil fuel infrastructure like Line 3, right? The phrasing in that bill, and then also in that piece of writing, the phrasing was incredibly, incredibly obstructive to developing economies. And it did not put enough burden onto the countries that have the most historic blame for the climate crisis emissions wise. So I think that really also needs to be considered. But I mean, we also need a drastic phase out. We need to make sure that this is like the top of our diplomatic agenda. We need to make sure that we can extend all of these amazing commitments that were made. There were so many commitments like outside of all of this stuff. So there's like the BOGA, the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance. So like seven countries in this one Canadian province committed to ending all of their new oil and gas exploration, which is incredible. And there's like a load of countries that are like, so they're the core members, this like Quebec and all these countries. And then there's like New Zealand, I think Portugal, and then California, state of California in the US, not US as a whole. They were all like significant steps, but they're not quite their kind of members. And that's what we need. We need coalitions of the willing. We need to make sure that there are leaders that are not just placing the entirety of the blame either on the diplomatic level, on the politicians level, or on the media level, and making sure that we are putting as much blame onto the US and onto the EU countries and onto the UK as we are onto India when it comes to being obstructionists to the coal phase out. I think that's something that we also need to figure out, like focus on, and we need to focus on things that are more than just the big Glasgow Pact stuff. We need to make sure that we're also using COP and these conferences that will come up on the run up to COP27, that we're using them as platforms to start new coalitions and to start new like relationships between countries that can help us to get to that point.
Yeah, I think you've talked about so many interesting things that it's really hard because I've got to pick one. But you've mentioned the global South and the global North a lot in like what you've been saying. And I think that's a really interesting topic specifically, especially since I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that India and China are part of the global South,
mm-hmm.
Which makes it very interesting that they're being blamed for this when the global North might have been a bit more involved mm-hmm. in the beginning. could you define the global south and the global north? And then
yeah, for sure, it's a definition that's quite contested actually. And like in general, I would say obviously it's got definitions that are like to do with the equator, so like south of the equator, north of the equator. But I would say that it's more, it's the term, like you only would say developed and developing countries, inverted commas for both. It's probably the better term to be used in place of that. The countries that you would consider to be developing are generally global south countries, both geographically and in terms of like economy and in terms of, I don't know, the way that the society is structured. I mean, also these global south countries, because of their geographic region, are normally the ones that are most vulnerable to this crisis. So they're the ones that are geographically in places where the islands will drown. Can islands drown? Islands will sink? I don't know. They are in places where climate-induced natural disasters will occur at a level that is catastrophic and that I don't think we can even imagine here in the UK. I think global north countries are generally ex-colonizers. They are generally countries that are fairly rich and fairly developed, and fairly developed in the sense of like economically developed. I wouldn't say that we're as developed in other areas, but yeah, there's a very clear divide at COP. What's really interesting actually about COP is that COP is kind of divided by region. I have literally no idea on the number of years for each, but we've just finished the European rounds of COP. So we had like all of the COPs being based in European countries, and now we're moving to, so the next COP is going to be in Egypt, and it's projected that the one after that, COP28, is going to be in the UAE. So we're kind of moving towards like a MENA region type thing, towards Africa and so-called Middle East. And I think that will really shift the dynamic of COP27 and COP28. I hope that it will shift the dynamic. I think that'll be something really interesting to come forward, is that we are now going to start seeing COPs that are in more global south countries. And we're going to start seeing COPs that are more, they're not in Glasgow, you know? And as much as it was hilarious seeing like the discourse on Twitter, where it was like everyone that was going up from London, because of course they're all coming from London to go to COP, they were all like, there was like a load of flooding or something that stopped all the train lines. So everyone was like stranded for hours on this train line. And that it was really ironic that going to this climate conference, there was a climate related disaster stopping them from being able to physically access it. As much as that is hilarious, we are also in the UK and we are by no means facing climate related disasters on the same level that my friends in the Philippines are, that my friends in Nigeria and in Kenya are. And I think seeing a different level of environment for countries that have historically more economic power, more negotiating power because of that. And they have this kind of like landed influence in their like coalitions between countries. It's going to be really interesting to see how that dynamic shifts because of a different geographical setting. I think that's also something that's like, it's just interesting. I think global south, global north divides, but also colonizer colonized divides really overshadow in a way that is not talked about enough all of these negotiations. And that's what I saw at COP26. There is a lot of not necessarily resentment, but resentment. Like there is a lot of just sadness and resignedness from global south countries, because they can see how colonialism, although it's not direct anymore, how it's persisting and how it's continuing in the way that these negotiations are structured. And I think that's something that is completely missed by a lot of media.
Yeah. So something you've been talking about a lot is actually colonialism. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on colonialism's impact on climate change.
Well, I mean, of course it's had an impact. It's not only in the direct sense, I keep saying direct and indirect, but not only in the direct sense, colonialism, say, I do a lot of work on the Middle East at uni right now. So colonialism, the French mandate and stuff in places like Syria, places like Lebanon, colonialism has laid a foundation in both of those countries of political instability, because the way that their political systems are structured because of it, they were structured under colonialism, are quite, not bureaucratic, but bureaucratic. Like they're quite sectarian in the sense that like they entrench social divides, and they entrench a divide of the upper classes, these like landed classes of political people, are the only ones, it's like a predetermined, they are going to be at the front of the political system. And it entrenches very harsh social divides that has informed the way that all of these countries have developed. So you can't underplay the impact, number one, in the indirect sense, how most ex-colonized countries are structured is entirely informed by colonialism. It's entirely informed by British, by Dutch, by colonizers. And that impacts how they approach those discussions, that impacts how they are able to organize within their country. That also impacts when you come into the negotiating room. There is unspoken power from developed countries, from these global North countries. There is an unspoken sense of, we put so much more like weight onto, for example, the US president or like the EU leaders than we ever would to countries in the global South. And that has a real impact on the levels that people enter that negotiation room with, on the kind of like power dynamics that are already there. And that makes it incredibly difficult to have an informed negotiation and have a balanced negotiation, particularly when it comes to a crisis that impacts disproportionately ex-colonized countries, global South countries, both geographically and because of their social cultural structures and because of their economic structures, which are all in some ways informed by their past of colonization. I think it informs it a lot, both in direct ways and in indirect ways, because it informs how stable these political structures are, it informs how the economic structures of these countries work, and it also informs how multilateral processes work. It also informs the ways those countries show up to that table, but also how that table is structured and what shape it is, whether or not it's round or whether or not there's somebody at the head of it, you know? It's colonialism informs a lot. I don't think we discuss it enough. And what I think is also, I work with a lot of like politicians, with a lot of like civil servant-y people, a lot of like big company people. And it's always dismissed, I think, when you talk about the impact of colonization as like identity politics, of like when we talk about climate justice, we talk about how the climate crisis intersects. Climate crisis is not just how the climate crisis exacerbates natural disasters. It's not just the physical geographical things. It's not just that. It's how the climate crisis disproportionately impacts, for example, the disabled community, because the disabled community is structurally stopped from being as financially advanced, as financially like stable, because a lot of disabled people aren't able to work. And same as like Black communities, as people of color. There are economic disadvantages, there are structures in place that stop many marginalized communities from accessing areas, like living areas, that are safer and that are away from toxic levels of air pollution. We had Elakisi Debra here in the UK who died of air pollution, and that's just the start, that's just the tip of that pyramid. We have a lot of air pollution here in the UK, and it is majority marginalized communities that are living in those areas, because that's where the cheaper housing is, that's where the cheaper accommodation is, because they are held back from doing anything more than that and from having the money to go into these like middle class like suburbia communities, you know. And you can talk about that, and it is dismissed as identity politics. It's dismissed as something that's just by the by, because it's climate is supposedly this great equalizer that we're all going to experience on the same level, and that's just categorically not true. We're all going to experience this in different ways, because we all show up in this world and experience this world in different ways, because disabled people are marginalized communities, because people of color are marginalized. And that informs the way that we're going to be able to adapt to and respond to and mitigate this crisis. And some people are going to be worse impacted than others because of that. And it's the same when it comes to colonization. Some countries are going to be incredibly worse impacted by this, because of how structurally they've been stopped from accessing the economic advancement, the development in inverted commas, as these other countries, you know?
You've talked about how the different communities will face different struggles because of their situation when it comes to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of intersects very well with what I know you're quite passionate about of climate justice,
mm-hmm.
and how like climate change and social activism can blend together. Could you like tell us a bit about that?
About how climate and social activism blends together. I think it kind of has to. It has to be done hand in hand. A lot of the people that I, when I first started and I did a lot of the like Youth Strike for Climate, the Fridays for Future strikes, we would also go together when the pandemic hit to the Black Lives Matter strikes. We would go to those protests because you can't divorce climate from all of these other social issues. Justice is, it's not just, I think there's a Martin Luther King quote along those lines that like true peace isn't just the absence of like direct conflict. It's the presence of justice. It's not just getting rid of this like geographical proclivity to different, like different events. It's not just the black and white. It's not just the science. It's everything. And it's the way that we experience the world and the way we experience society. Justice is not going to come by just focusing on one little box. It's not going to come when you just like siphon things off. Like when we talk about climate education, we're not going to create a resilient workforce in the future if we siphon climate into just the geography and into STEM subjects, into the separate sciences. You know, we're not going to get a resilient workforce that way. And it's the same here. We're not going to get an adequate response to the climate crisis. We're not going to get an adequate global response to it if we keep siphoning it off into only these politicians can focus on it, or it's only the science, so only these people that can understand everything that's in this BBC News article can care about this stuff. Everyone can care about it. And that's important when it comes to how we respond to it, but it's also important in that it needs to intersect with every single social issue that we have, because it's always going to intersect, because the climate crisis is like it's like the final boss of all of these social crises, because it brings all of them together and brings the worst things out of all of them. Because the way that we could ever respond to climate change is by working together as a global community, and the ways that we could work together as a global community are so tinged and flavored and polluted by uneven social dynamics, both between countries and within countries, between class divides. The climate crisis demands that we all work together in a way that is incredibly difficult in a society that is so divided, and in a society that's so polluted by so many social injustices on a daily basis. You can't ever divide them. You can't ever just be a scientist, you know, on working on climate. It has to be linked to social justice. Otherwise, it's just gardening. I found that's a quote somewhere. Like, climate justice, climate change, climate activism without justice is just gardening. That's one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think what you're describing is a phrase that's commonly heard. It's climate justice. And I was wondering, as you're part of MotCop as well, could you tell us what climate justice is for our listeners who might not know what it is, and how it links to MotCop?
Climate justice is the idea that the only way, I'm a politics student, right? And I've been doing a lot of modules that are absolutely destroying me inside, but they're incredibly interesting. And there's an idea of positive and negative peace, right? I think it's Galtung, I don't know. But negative peace is the absence of this direct violence, the absence of this like the immediate war and conflict. Whereas positive peace is not only the absence of that direct violence, that direct conflict, it's also the absence of structural violence, of structural, structural conflict, and of cultural violence. And it's the same concept, climate justice. We could mitigate the climate crisis in a solely black and white way, and on solely the scientific level, but that wouldn't be climate justice, because climate justice would be structuring and redeveloping our society in a way that makes sure that this can never happen again, making sure that we're not going to keep repeating ourselves in a groundhog day of all groundhog days, making sure that we address these social injustices that have led us to this point, because you could argue that the climate crisis is a result of the intersections of all of these social injustices. It's the intersections of the way that we treat each other and the way that we see ourselves as national countries as our interests are the most important as individuals or as a country. And we don't think about how that impacts other people, how that impacts the global community. Climate justice is changing that. It's flipping that on its head. It's making sure that we live in a world that works for everybody and that doesn't systemically discriminate against certain groups, against certain people. It's making sure that we live in a world free of human rights abuses. We live in a world where people have a right to a healthy environment and have a right to be heard in their political institutions and have a right to be heard if they so please on the multilateral level, on the global level. We need to, in order to achieve climate justice, it's not just about working on climate change, it's about working on everything. You know, it's about restructuring how the UN works. It's about restructuring how political institutions work so that they focus more on stakeholder engagement, and stakeholder engagement not just from an advisory point of view, not just from like, let's get some young people on board to advise us on this and let's get them to do some many, many free consulting hours for us. It's about paying those young people. It's about giving those young people a stake. It's about giving those young people like power in that room, making sure that we have an equal say compared to the adults and making sure that we have equal access to information, you know? It's one thing to address things on the surface level, and it's another thing to uproot the polluted things that have gotten us to this point, you know, and that's what climate justice is. Climate justice is about bringing us to a point where we can exist peacefully and well in this world, which I think should be a bare minimum, and it breaks my heart that we're not at that point.
Yeah. You've done an amazing job of talking, because you've brought us on right to the topic we were about to talk about, which was, you were talking about like youth being brought to the conference and be like, tell us your opinions, and then completely ignoring the opinions. Mm. And the idea that I think I remember hearing you mention in an interview, the idea of youth washing.
Yeah.
And like how that's basically what that is in that sense. Mm. And could you expand on the way which it feels to be youth washed and how you think you would change that?
Yeah, of course. I think a lot of the work that I do, because I'm a politics student, you know, I understand even in a small way how all of these systems work. So I think my role in this is to try and figure out how the hell we can lobby for this particular policy ask and how we can work within that department in the government. You know, that's where I fit into a lot of this conversation and a lot of this advocacy work. So I think I've felt it quite intensely, because the way that we are engaged as young people, particularly in those political spaces, is a photo opportunity. We are included in that room, not because people value what we have to say, but because they want the photo opportunity of them shaking hands with the young person in front of their little like banner for their campaign. You know, it's because they want us to inspire them. They want us to do the emotive heavy speeches, and they don't want us to actually give them solid policy recommendations, because they're not going to listen to them. Because as I was saying before, because they will just nod and carry on with what they were already doing. Like, as a young person in those spaces, it's incredibly, incredibly intimidating. But that's felt in conjunction with young people being at the center of this conversation. Young people, I would say, are the reason that COP26 was able to be so ambitious, is because we put that pressure onto politicians and because we did those emotive things. But that doesn't mean that young people can't be experts in our own right. And we are not treated that way. We're treated as people that can like do the social media pages. We're treated as people that can make TikToks and they can like keep people hip. You know, we're not treated as experts either in our lived experience or in policy or in like specific policy areas. When I do interviews, like it's so weird saying when I do interviews with like little newspaper things, they ask me how it feels to be a young person. They asked me what it's like, and they asked me about like myself and like my emotions and all that kind of thing. And that's important, but they've never asked me about how I feel about these specific policy things. They've never asked me these things that I've spent my entire life studying up. I say my entire life, like a couple of years, but like they have never asked me or my colleagues about what we feel about this particular negotiation. They've never treated us like our opinion matters in that way, because it doesn't to them. To us, we're just, to them, we are just a cool, like, cool left field story. The story for them, the hook of the story is that this young person is in this space that's like the median age of about 50, you know? there's somebody that looks different in this space. Oh, let's go talk to them about how it feels to be different. When they're not appreciating us as people that have something to say and people that are experts and people that have a right to participate in these public affairs, they're treating us as like almost as an object, almost as something that, it's just as an inanimate object, I think, is how I feel a lot of the time. And I feel like I'm used as a box to tick of civil society engagement. They will always want to say, we've done many events where we've worked with people and they have put all over all of these messaging. They've been like, and like all in those like pitching conversations where they're like looking for funding, they're like, we're co-designing this with young people and we're co-organizing it. And this is like an equal event with the young people of the world. You're hearing from everybody. And number one, the young people that they're engaging are young people that are already engaged. They're not putting effort into engaging with young people who have no idea what the climate crisis is. And they're just kind of like scared at home, not understanding any of this. They're not engaging on it in a meaningful way. They're engaging with the young people that are willing to pester them and email them until they get something, you know. But number two, they're not actually engaging with us, because all of the conversations that we ever have are just, we make suggestions and they nod and then they ignore them. They just plow on with all the stuff that they've already got, but they just have a young person on the Zoom call, normally with their camera off because they feel so uncomfortable. You know, it's not made to be a welcoming environment and there's no effort put into it. Young people are normally not paid. You know, it's an incredibly unwelcoming and unequal environment where young people are youth washed, where we're used as a hook for a media spin, where we're used as something that is, we're used because it's the hot topic of the moment and not because our opinions are actually valued. Mm. And that's incredibly crushing, I think, especially my colleagues that came so far to get to Glasgow. They traveled across continents from areas that are being most impacted by this crisis and from people in areas that are being most impacted by this crisis. And they come into a space where they think, finally, I'm going to be listened to. And it's just the same as it has always been. And that is incredibly, incredibly crushing.
Yeah, I think what you've just described is actually so relatable for so many young people across the world.
You've talked a lot about how they haven't included you in or asked your opinion about the policy changes specifically and like this specific thing. They're just asking you about emotions and how frustrating that is. I think we'd love to hear your opinion about like the specific, like your solutions that you believe in, also the policy changes that have been made during COP, because we mentioned phase out coal, but also the other ones. Would you mind giving your opinion on that?
I mean, that's incredibly broad.
Sorry.
I think, although I have many thoughts, what are the key things? And the key thing is, to be honest, coal changes, coal phase out. I think we also had an incredibly weak outcome on loss and damage, which is what I was talking about earlier, that loss and damage is a lifeline for countries. It's a lifeline for countries that are being impacted right now. And you can't expect those countries to come to that table in a way that is akin to being able to like have that conversation and to be able to negotiate in a meaningful way when they are coming from a place where they are knee deep in water, you know, like that speech that was given when the representative was knee deep in water addressing that speech. That's how these countries will show up to these conversations. So that is incredibly important. But I think number two, COP26 had, I'm actually not sure how many, 503, I think, but I might need to check on that. 503 delegates. So like the official people at COP26 that had sizable links to the fossil fuel industry. You can't expect to negotiate an effective climate solution when your conference is full of fossil fuel lobbyists. You can't expect. That is the biggest delegation. It's more than any other country. The second biggest was Brazil, which had 479 representatives. you can't expect any effective or ambitious climate solution to happen when the people in that room have vested interests in the exact opposite of what you're fighting for, you know? And it's important, I think, for like to engage these people, to engage the people that are being villainized in a sense. It's important, I think, to make sure that we're talking to oil execs, not in a sense of sympathizing with them in absolutely any way, because I would personally say that they are complicit in a lot of murders across the world. But we need to understand how these economic processes work, and we need to understand how we can transition in a just way away from fossil fuels and into the renewables, into something that is more conducive, finally, to a peaceful world. We need to make sure that these people are being engaged, but there's a difference between being engaged and having 503 sizably linked to the fossil fuel industry delegates present at COP with decision-making powers. I think what we also need to do is make sure, I think a lot of my focus is on how COP is structured, because I don't think COP is structured in a way that is conducive to particularly good negotiations, both in the sense of that fossil fuel lobbyist influence at COP, also in the sense that like Taiwan was blocked from China from participating, and Taiwan is particularly climate vulnerable, you know? There are a lot of structural issues. Only 3 of 14 Pacific Island states were able to send delegates. There were a lot of issues, particularly at this COP, that made it. There was some new spin, like 5 months before COP, something like that, where it was like, this is going to be the most inclusive COP ever. And we were all clowning on it on Twitter because we were like, what do you mean that this is going to be the most inclusive COP ever, when the COVID like travel rules are all over the place, to the point where people are dropping thousands on quarantine, and then you take it out of the red list like a day later, like for the first day of COP or like a couple of days before COP. What do you mean it's going to be the most inclusive COP ever when you start these vaccine provisions past the point when it will be, because you need a set period after you get your vaccine before you're like considered able to go into conference spaces, or you need periods of time between each vaccine. So if you have no vaccines, you're able to get them as a COP delegate, and then you get your first one, you physically wouldn't have time before entering the conference venue to be fully vaccinated in the way that is like best and is least going to put people in danger. That is just structurally not an inclusive space, and I think we need to address that before we get to absolutely anything else, because I think that also informs the way that everything else happens. Like that informs, like Article 6 was settled, which is amazing. There's a lot of things. The US and China did a lot of things at COP which were incredible, but they could have been so much better if we had better negotiation strategy, we had better diplomatic strategy, we made sure that everyone was able to come to this table as an equal partner in a global community that is entirely equal when you really come down to it. Like, we need to put so much more focus on the influence that, or not the influence, but the importance that countries that are experiencing the effects of the climate crisis have at that table, because these people know how to mitigate to and how to adapt to the climate crisis more than any of us here in the global north will. And they're the experiences that we should be listening to. Indigenous communities are the people that we should be listening to. Young people from the global south are people that we should be listening to. And when it comes to like education, these are the people that are suffering the most, and they know how people are feeling. They know how we're going to feel. So these are the people we need to be learning from and listening to on the global scale. These are the voices that we need to be uplifting. And I don't think that's was done nearly enough at COP26. I think, yeah, again, to quote Nathan, thank you. It's not the COP26 outcomes are good, but they could have been better. Is that they're very bad and they could have been worse. And that's a fundamental difference. I think there were many things that could have done better. And I hope that answers your question. It was quite a broad question.
I think you did an amazing job of talking about it. You seem like the sort of person who we could just listen to for like hours.
Oh, I could rant for ages, man.
Is there anything like you think is the most important thing to like for people to take away when thinking about the climate crisis?
The way that we think about the climate crisis in general, the thing that is the most important is to recognize that climate change isn't something that's just going to happen in the future, it's something that's happening right now. That's, it seems so basic, but it's something that people forget so often, that there are people in this world right now, not in 10 years time, not in 20 years time, right now and years past, that are experiencing these effects on a catastrophic scale, whose houses are being destroyed, who have lost their lives, who have lost their livelihoods, who have lost their source of food. There are people whose economies are being absolutely destroyed and that are losing their jobs because of it, or that are becoming refugees. There are people that are suffering right now, and that's why we need urgency. It's because this is something that is happening right now, and we're not even at that 1.5 level. And that 1.5 level is our, it's our last chance. And it's only a percentage chance, but it's our last chance. Mm-hmm. We need to keep in mind, above all else, that this is an urgent crisis that is happening right now, and a crisis that I think is being played second fiddle to COVID right now. But the climate crisis is going, it's going to affect us on such a bigger way. It's on level of COVID, if not worse, because this is something that is only going to get worse over time. And it's also something that the countries with economic influence, the countries that have the money, that are developed in inverted commas as global North countries, we are only going to start experiencing the effects of the climate crisis in the future, and when it's too late to act and when it's too late to stop it. It's already going to be past the tipping point by the time we start experiencing these effects. And if there's one thing I've learned about the global North, is that we're only going to start doing things when we start, like, it starts coming on our front door and it starts affecting our daily lives. So I think we need to start communicating the stories of people in the global South. We need to start making sure that those are the voices that are at the forefront of things like COP26, and not just like the negotiation tables. I also mean, because COP26 is more than just a negotiation platform now. That's what it is in the dictionary definition, but it's more than that now. It's a media moment. Like COP26 particularly, it was like a culmination of climate efforts. And I'm worried slightly that it's kind of come to a bit of a crescendo, and we're now going to be like just fighting uphill again to try and get climate coverage in the news. But COP is so much more than just negotiations now. It's a platform for media to talk about climate, and I'm fed up with the same, to be quite frank, voices like ours, people in the UK. I'm fed up with those being the only voices that are listened to. I'm fed up of it being people that sound like me. And I know that's ironic given that I'm talking right now, but I'm fed up of it. I want the people that are given the mic, I want the people that are given these platforms to be people that are feeling these effects right now. I want it to be people that are from marginalized backgrounds. I want people who can talk about that succinctly, people who English isn't their first language. You know, I want more diverse voices on the table, not just because it'd be nice, but because it's our lifeline, because that's the only way that we're going to convince politicians and the general public in countries like the UK that this is a crisis that needs to be tackled right now, and that this is a crisis that needs to be tackled above all else. Because right now you see a lot of people, my parents and like my family members included, much to my disgust, and that will be a major topic of conversation at the Christmas dinner table, let me tell you, but they will say things like, oh, but you can't inconvenience our daily lives. Like, oh, but we've established the way that we're going to exist. We've established, like, this is just how we live our lives. You can't disrupt that. And we're unwilling to take even minor inconveniences, because I think we don't understand. We understand, but we don't get it. Like, we don't fully deep the situation that we are in. And I think we need that really, really desperately. That's what I want. I want the most affected people in areas to be at the forefront of all of our discussions, because that's the only way we're going to solve this.
Yeah, and we completely agree with you. Thank you so much for your time. It's actually been so interesting, insightful, and informative. We were just wondering, could you give our listeners your handles on social media in case they're interested?
Yes, I'm at Phoebe L. Hansen. So that's PHOEBLHANSON. On pretty much everything, I think.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Swap It Up podcast. We would like to thank the podcast producer, Neha, the podcast editor, Janice, and the podcast executive producer, Zakia. Remember to check out our social media. We are at Swap It Up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Remember also to check out our blogs on the website. Stay tuned for the next episode.